Thank you for listening to this gospel resource from Cornerstone Baptist Church in Wylie, Texas. Feel free to use or share this resource, but we ask that you not alter the content in any way. For more information about Cornerstone Baptist Church, please visit us at cornerstonewylie.org.
Well, good morning. This is Sunday, April the 6th. We're on Bible in a Year. This last week, we got through most of the book of Judges. There are three chapters left in the reading, so you should have started with Judges 1 and gone through Judges 18. I'm not counting today. So today you will finish Judges in the reading plan. And so that's today. We'll talk about Judges. Does anybody have anything to say or any overall impressions of what you've read so far in Judges?
I have so many things.
This is why we like Sarah. She has so many things. When we did this in the youth group, the first time with her years ago, she had reams of notebooks. And she just kept the discussion going. So it's great. So what do you got? You're not ready?
Okay, so I actually don't know, because I started somewhere in the middle of the week. So I don't know where we started.
Judges 1, the very first chapter. Yeah.
When was Judges 9:7? When Jotham like gets on top of the whatever, the hill or something, he makes a speech and then like runs away and hides. Which I think is so interesting the way people did things back then, like the announcement or whatever. Like, if we go on Facebook and that's how we I don't know. It's just like, I'm gonna go on the stone, say what I have to say, and then hide.
Oh yeah, 9:21, right?
Yeah.
He escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. Yeah. So he got on top of a hill and...
Is that just how people
made
him?
Made his speech and then ran away.
Well, I mean, he just had all 69 of his brothers killed. So I would want to make a speech from a little ways away.
Yeah. So I'm curious, how does that work? Like, do people come up and listen to the person that goes up on that specific hill, or you just make a speech to the wind?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, it's got to be that he goes up there and he lifted up his voice and called out really loud, so that it's just that maybe it was an ideal space to just yell at people from.
I think the acoustics of when you're on top of a hill and there's a valley, the acoustics work better.
Yeah, maybe it was, it doesn't say though, but maybe it was just a common place where if you wanted to yell, cry out at various people, that's where you could go and do it from. So, okay.
Let's go to Judges 2. This time the angel of Yahweh seems to say things that Yahweh would say. Mm-hmm. More explicitly. I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers.
Yeah, are you in a certain verse?
Oh, yeah, first couple verses of Judges 2.
Yeah.
So I think in some of these accounts it seems much more blatant.
Yeah.
Or a theophany or a Christophany. Yeah, probably. Yeah. At least you could be saved that it's a theophany, I suppose.
Well, even later you have that angel appearing to Manoah, Samson's father, mm-hmm. and he was like, we're going to die now. Cause, was that him or his wife? But one of them said thought they were going to die then because they'd seen God.
Yeah. His wife consoles him, is like, he's intending to do good to us, so I think we're fine.
Yeah. So we have a lot of, I don't know, like your overall impression of Judges, when you read it, like, does it put you in a certain mood, or are you Are you? What are you thinking about, like, just the nation of Israel as a whole when you read this book?
They've just fallen. It seems like they've fallen so far since Joshua. Like, you know, by God's grace, they were holding it together. They were being faithful to God and obeying Him. And he gave them the land, but just without the leadership of a godly leader, it's just, you know, one generation may do well, the next generation plummets, and God gives them into the hands of people who should have done it long ago.
I think with the pace of the chapters, like, you know, when a judge rises up and there's peace in the land, like, it makes it sound like it's happening, like, back to back, but, like, when Othniel came to power, there was rest in the land for 40 years before they rebelled again, and Udud had to come, and so it's, I think, just, like, paying attention to those time markers, too. Like, it seems like, and a year later...
Yeah.
Go and rebel, but it's been, for most of us, it's like more years that have passed than I've been alive, so.
Yeah, I mean, for perspective, it's really about 300 years from the death of Joshua until maybe Samuel comes along. So, and it, at one point, that's towards the end there. It says we've had this land for 300 years, right? When they're complaining, it's the Ammonites, right, talking to them. And one of the judges at the end there, maybe it was Jer or something, said, we've had this for 300 years. But think about that. Like, how long has the United States been around? And so it... For me, it's like, well, don't you remember all the stuff that God did for you? And I'm like, no, I don't remember anything about any of those people who lived in, you know, colonial times. Like, I don't have any connection to them other than their written words. And we actually probably have a lot more written words about those people than they did here. So they're going by word of mouth. And they do have the written Torah and things like that, that they would read about. But so we want to... I'm not excusing them, but we want to say that, oh, they forgot the Lord. But some of them probably didn't even know Him. Or, you know about it or were told about it. But anyway, again, it was 300 years of all this time that goes by. So, okay, anything else?
This is jumping ahead slightly, but the last verse of Judges, I think, is a good summary for the whole book.
I didn't read that, because that's today. So what's the last verse of Judges?
21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Okay, right. But they actually say that in several times in, like, chapter 17, verse 6, and chapter 18, verse 1, and chapter 19, verse 1. So there's actually two themes here in Judges, and that's one of them that you pick up on. So what's the other theme, probably? Because that's the one thing. No king, and everyone did what's right in their own eyes. And so if you had to think of another theme, what is it? Maybe you'll get it. I wrote it down. Can you read my mind? Come on, Adam. Come on, read my mind.
They did evil.
Yeah, exactly. There. And the people of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And it doesn't necessarily say that whole sentence the whole time, but it does say, and the people of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. That's in 2:11, 3:7, 3:12, 4:1, 6:1, 8:33, 10:6, and 13:1. So that it's just this common thing over and over. They did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they worshiped the Baals. Who are the Baals? We need to cover that.
Baals.
Baal comes up constantly. in the Old Testament. And then you have also the Ashtaroth or Ashtoreth. So, do you know what those are? Do I have to tell you?
Goddess of fertility or
something? Right, so luckily this Bible has a little note in the side that says here's what Baal is and here's what Ashtoreth is. But yeah, Baal means lord, owner, possessor, or husband, and was the Canaanite god of fertility. Baal was often part of compound names like Baal Peor. And then you have Ashtaroth, which is the plural form of Ashtoreth, and that was another Canaanite goddess of fertility, love, and war. And then the note goes further to say, according to Greek mythology, which that's an interesting statement here, that Ashtoreth was the wife of Baal. So you always have Baal and Ashtoreth kind of together in when it mentions them in the Old Testament, they're almost always together.
Is that where we get the word, the god Ishtar from, and Easter, the word Easter itself?
I wonder. Yeah. I probably knew that like 10 years ago, but forgot it. Yeah. Because it's a similar sounding thing. Yeah.
So what is it about fertility? Is it like a common problem, I wonder, back then? Of all the gods?
Maybe it is, you know. Maybe they were all infertile. Which is why would God bless them at all? And so maybe it was a thing to want to be fertile, because maybe it just wasn't as common as, maybe it was very common with the Israelites, but maybe it was less common. I don't know.
I can see the desperation. They're like, we want to trust in Yahweh, but really want to have kids. We'll try anything and everything. Maybe we'll have kids. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that one of the verses, like, I know some of the blessing was tied to the land, like it wouldn't rain.
Yeah, it was a curse that they wouldn't be fertile if they didn't obey the command of the Lord. Sure.
This might be a stretch, but like, or, I don't know, stretch, but Gideon, his other name was Jerubbaal.
Jerubbaal, yeah.
Is that, I don't know, because of the ending, similar to just Baal?
Well, it's he's contending with Baal. That's what that means?
Okay.
So the people wanted to kill him, but I think his father said, you know, would you contend with I'm just, this is all memory, right? But you know, would you contend for Baal? You know. So basically, I think his father was saying, like, Baal will fight his own battles. So my son Gideon is contending with Baal, Jerubbaal. Which is kind of interesting, you know. You could say, I don't know, we contend with Satan or something, and that's your name. Like, that would be so weird. Yeah, I don't know.
In chapter 11, the stranger it is, but when Jephthah makes his vow to the Lord,
yeah.
It says, Jephthah made a vow, 11 verse 30, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer that for a burnt offering. And I can't read that without thinking he's thinking of a living something, you know, a human, an animal. But it sounds like he only has one daughter, and he obviously is distraught that, you know, that she came out to meet him. So is it a stretch to think maybe he was hoping his wife would come out to meet him?
Oh, gosh.
I'm not even like. It just how I mean, you know, does he usually have slaves that comes out to meet him, and he was just assuming one of them, you know, like, who was he thinking was going to come out and meet him, you know, coming back from battle?
that, and it said that it was normal for family to come out in celebration if you won a battle. So that's why I'm like,
it was a hasty wow, so he was just desperate and he made it. And
possibly, maybe that's...
Yeah, I lean more there. It is a hasty vow. The other weird thing is that in 31 it says, then it shall be that whatever... You could, there's a note that I read somewhere that said that could be whoever. So maybe he really said whoever, but then again, it's like whoever or whatever comes out of the doors of my house. Well, this can't be anything but something living, because how do they come out if they're not able to move, right? So that's just like probably a really dumb, hasty vow that he regretted saying. I mean, definitely he regretted saying it because there's his daughter.
Which is interesting because in 29, it starts off that section by saying, then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah. And so it seems kind of in excess that he made that, or you know, like you said, out of fear or anxiety. Because I read that and think to myself, God already had intended for Balaamites to fall under his hand.
Yeah. And then it's like, I've given my word to the Lord and I cannot take it back. Really? Like, is he going to hold you to that rash vow? Also, you know, this is God who we know doesn't like human sacrifice at all. So is he really going to expect that to happen? And... you know, it looks like they thought he would expect that to happen because she was sacrificed, you know, which is really, really strange to me.
I mean, wasn't there a whole bit in like Deuteronomy about not making oaths without, you know, considering the consequences?
Yeah.
And this definitely seems like one of those cases where he just... he didn't know that he, you know, he should have.
Yeah.
And the right response would probably be to not follow through with it and bear the consequences of breaking the oath.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, it's hard to put yourself in somebody's place, but if I had to put myself in this guy's place, I would have said, no way. Like, kill me instead or something. Like, that's not gonna happen. But it's just another example of these people not fully trusting in God, and I mean that's the entire book of Judges, really. I mean, if you want an outline, you know, you kind of look at chapters 1 and 2 and it tells you the condition of the nation of Israel after the death of Joshua. And you have like some military victories there. And then you get the era of the judges, which is 3 to 16. And if you think about this, really... starting in 17, Judges, they say Judges is not necessarily chronological, but 3 to 16 is, but then when you get to 17, that didn't necessarily happen right after, you know, Samson. But you have the era of Judges, and there's 7 apostasies that happen in the chapter, and then you get the judges that deliver them in some way. But what do you think of the judges overall?
There's a woman judge.
There's a woman judge, and she was probably the best one, right?
Didn't she go into battle?
Yeah. Well, Barak did, but she was the leader.
Yeah.
Right. And if so, honestly, if you had to look at all the judges and say which one was the most faithful and the best, it's probably Deborah.
Or Samuel. Who comes next?
Samuel. Oh, Samuel. Yeah, yeah. Well, right. I just don't think of him as a judge, but he is. Because, but yeah, he comes after the book of Judges. Right.
Samuel.
Yep.
It is interesting in five.
I was thinking you said Samson at first.
No.
Oh, Samuel. All right, it was interesting in five.
Yeah, in chapter five, in my mind, I kind of compared it to the song, the Israelite song, after the Egyptians, God closed the Red Sea on them. It was very, very, very God-focused, and you know, the horse and the rider, he's thrown into the sea. But in the song that covers really all of chapter 5, Deborah and Jael, they're like, I don't know, really sharing the spotlight with God for, you know, what's happened in the previous chapter, and the song is very focused on them and, you know, their, what they did as opposed to, you know, thanks to God. Even though there is some of that in there, it's just, it's kind of man-centered.
Yeah.
So I had a question.
Okay.
Kind of a little bit before I judge it. But I feel like it's an important one. Sorry, okay with me, going back. But in Joshua 22:5, it says, "Only keep yourselves very carefully to do the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded you. Love Yahweh your God and walk in all his ways and keep his commandments and cling to him and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." I'm curious, how do we know which commandments to keep and why do we stick to the Ten Commandments? Like, how are we confident about the Ten Commandments? Maybe there's verses that talk about that, but like, there's so many things about, like, you know, we have the verses about homosexuality, which we apply to today, and other things that we apply to today that aren't even mentioned in the New Testament, which I know is sometimes how we know we keep that commandment. But then there's other verses that's like, so we can't wear cloth of two different materials, or we can't, or I don't know. Anyway.
There's some distinction between, like, the moral law and the civil law. So some of that is just, like, this is how to distinguish Israel from the rest of the nations. And then there's the moral law, which the Ten Commandments fall into. Yeah, but you're saying, like, a lot, like, how do you know what's a real commandment versus...
Well, one that applies to us today.
Yeah.
I don't know what applies to us today and doesn't.
Yeah,
in the same
chapter,
there's things that we apply to today, and if we don't apply to today, it's in the same chapter. So.
Yeah, Pastor Jeff actually touched on it.
Oh, he did. Okay.
We talked about the division of the law, ceremonial, civil, and moral. That's kind of how you ascertain what remains. The moral law is forever.
Right.
Maybe you should ask him why. Why is one?
Well, like in early in Acts, that vision that Peter has, you know, the sheet that comes down, and God has to tell him three times, even though he kind of hesitates, like, hey, everything is, you know, that whole side of the law is done away with. You can eat all of these things now that you couldn't eat before. And so that's a very clear, just, you know, one third of that, that those categories that's just been washed away. I think maybe it was Jeff as well talked about, you know, the Christ came, the Helper came, and he's written the law. Like, he indwells us as believers, and the law is written on our hearts as opposed to something that's outside of us. So we hold on to the Ten Commandments because it's now written on our hearts, not this. I can't remember how he worded it, but it was helpful.
I think the Ten Commandments are the essence of God's character and nature itself, and so that continues throughout time. It is the basis for everything we do. However, all the other laws were ceremonial laws or civil laws, which were specific to Israel.
Yeah.
The nation of Israel.
And I just stick with the Ten Commandments too, because they're written on the tablets by God. himself. They're the ones that were placed in the Ark of the Covenant. And then you get to the New Testament and you get this lawyer asking Jesus in Matthew 22, what's the greatest commandment in the law? And he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Well, that's the first four commandments summarized. And then he said, then this, and this is the great and foremost commandment. And then, you know, Jesus says, the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, that's the rest of the commandments. And he goes, and on these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. So those two summaries, which are summaries of the Ten Commandments, you know, are then the whole law and the prophets. So I think that's why the emphasis is so much on the Ten Commandments.
Oh, does that help you? Okay.
I still wonder about other things.
Yeah, the picking and choosing is, I think, it's a good thing for us to look more into, because that's an argument a lot of people will use against it, that they're picking and choosing the law. So.
Yeah, I feel like they do that sometimes. Like, we pick and choose and we make a strong case for it. And it's like, well, what about these other ones then? I don't know. It's hard.
It's hard to pick and choose. Yeah, it's not where, like, a crux comes down to, like, how people view, like, theonomy type people, the folks who think that, Christians, like, there will be like a resurgence, I guess, in terms of the structures of government will reflect the law of God just very similarly to how they did during the earliest times of Israel, with the goal of not, I don't know if then that's where like the parsing out comes with, what do you mean, are we stoning people, like are we going there, or like how we do it, but there are a lot of good faith arguments, I mean, people trying to figure out exactly how those things apply now, but I was always, I mean, our structure of government is different than Israel's being literally led by God, you know, with the priest being at the top. But I don't know, it's a tough one.
Some of these like commandments, they're directly tied to like, the land, like God's gonna bless their land. Like we know that we're not Israel and we're not living in the promised land. We don't believe in that replacement theology. So I think in some regards, the commandments that are tied to the land, it's easier for us to parse between what the things that can be carried forward into the new covenant and things that are directly tied to Israel because they were not to be like the inhabitants of the rest of the land. They're supposed to be distinct and set apart.
Right.
And somewhere forward pointing to Christ. The reason we don't have priests now is because the final high priest has arrived.
Yeah.
And so that takes away all of temple worship, everything. It takes away everything. All of that was just a mirror to what was to come in the future.
Okay.
Definitely not going to hash it out today.
Yeah, I mean, that's the struggle is that you... Like, that's a ringer for me, is to bring that in, right? Because I wasn't thinking about that with judges. So you try to prepare, and I'm like, And then Sarah throws the wrench in, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, maybe it's legitimate to take moral principles from some of those rather than applying them specifically? And maybe that's why we pick and choose a little bit, because some of them are so, like, specific that it doesn't apply. But then, you know, like, keep a fence around your roof. Okay, we have a draft principle that we're to regard the life of our, you know, guests.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also that he just takes sin very seriously, because you've got all the adultery stuff, and it's like, stone them. Mm-hmm. You know, and like kill them immediately because you're supposed to purge the evil from your midst. And so it's like, oh, you know, in that young nation, if somebody gets away with that and they're not gone, they're going to influence the whole society, which we're really struggling in Judges, because we're seeing Canaanite people influence the entire society. And it even happens before they enter the Promised Land. You know, there's all these outside influences. So if you have internal influences and people get away with it, then it's just really bad news. So, you know, he was trying to set them apart. So you stone them for adultery, but we don't do that today. But yet it is a very serious sin and a very serious evil. I mean, so that's the principle of it all.
Like they saw the cloud hanging over the tabernacle, like mm-hmm. they could see the presence of God in the middle of their camp. And I think I tend to forget that. And so it's like, okay, God is dwelling among us. What do we do now? And God gives the law. And this is how you are to conduct yourself in His presence. And so there is this, you know, I mean, even in the New Covenant, we should be reverent and careful to do what He commands, but just like that physical reminder, he's in the middle of the camp. And just, yeah, I think very sobering.
Right. There's this whole concept too of testing. So if you look at the end of the chapter 2 and the beginning of 3, he leaves nations in the Promised Land in order to test Israel. That's chapter 3, verse 1. And so they're tested for their faithfulness by having these other nations around them. So how are you tested today? Are you tested today? How are we tested today? Yeah, there's the nation of sin all around us.
Trials.
Yeah, and we have James, James chapter 1, where you could kind of tie this in. In James chapter 1, 2, and 3, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. So we're tested as Christians, not in order to condemn us, but as a way to strengthen our faith and increase our reliance upon God. And what the people in Judges, the Israelites, if they pass the test, what do they get? The testing, what do they get? I'm going to contrast that with what we get, but what do you think they get? Huh? Peace and rest in the land and living in the Promised Land. Yeah. And so if we're tested today, you can stay in James chapter 1 and we get a far better thing. And you go to verse 12 in James chapter 1. It says, "Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him." So that's a far better thing than just being in the land and resting in the land. What else? We're going to wrap up. We've got to wrap up. So a lot of this is, for me, it's that we have Israel in the land. It's a period of 300 years. They forget all the things that God has done for them, and then they cry out to the Lord and they need a judge to deliver them, and the judge in some way delivers them, and they have rest in the land for a while, and then they forget again, and this cycle just happens over and over and over. And you can think about memory being a gift, and what we're going to do today in the service is do this in remembrance of me, right? We're going to have the Lord's Supper, and we have this tangible, I'm tying this into the Lord's Supper, which is weird because I didn't plan to, but you know, you have this tangible thing, you know, we can chew on it, the piece of bread, and we can drink the liquid, and we can ponder what they mean. And it's as if God knows our memory is so bad that he's providing a way for us to remember him, and we do this periodically. So we're there, and we're trying to remember, and this is just from another preacher that I used to listen to all the time, but he says memory is a gift. Remembering the past teaches us countless lessons about how we ought to live today. The Israelites forgot. They didn't remember the miraculous events that brought them to their land or the covenant that united them to their God. But God did not forget his covenant, and because of his great love for his people, he disciplined his sinful children so that they might return to him. So have you forgotten the great works that God has done in your life? Perhaps your difficult circumstances are overpowering your faith. Do you feel as if he's disciplining you? And so if you go to Hebrews, we'll tie this to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5 through 11. Because you can kind of see in Judges, this was a testing, and they were being disciplined every time one of these nations came in and attacked them and subjected them. But if you go to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5 through 11, it says, "And have you forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are approved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you were without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness." So that's what I kind of think of with Judges. It's just this constant disciplining of the Lord and bringing them back. And him remembering his covenant with them, whereas they don't remember. But, you know, thank God, you know, that he's provided a way for us to remember his covenant with us. And that's this, again, that's this tangible Lord's Supper that we're going to do. And, you know, we have to sit there and wait while it's passed out for others. And, you know, I'm sitting there like, wow, like, what a great thing this is. I'm like, the whole time I'm just like meditating on what God has done for me as I'm waiting, because I don't normally wait with something in my hand. But, you know, as I'm waiting, I'm just sitting there thinking the whole time, what a great thing that God has done. He has shed his blood for us, and he has broken his body for us to save us from our sins and to draw us back to himself. So that's what I got. Let's pray. God, our Father, I thank you for this time together. I thank you for remembrances that you provide. And I thank you that you always remember your covenant with us. And even though that we are unfaithful, that you are faithful. And we just pray that your hand is on our life and that you guide and direct us, and that you give us a love for your word, and that it doesn't return to you void. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.